Radio.
Catholicism in American Politics, JFK Onward, a talk by Father Bill Miscambell for the Dawson Centre in Hobart.
Thank you. This climate is of no worry to me whatsoever. It's like a fall day in South Bend, Indiana, where I think this past year we went for about 40 days at sub-zero temperature. That is a challenge, let me assure you. I'm very delighted to be here with you. I want to thank David, thank the Archbishop, and thank Madeline, whom I've just met, for their graciousness in welcoming me. And I especially want to thank, of course, each one of you for coming here this afternoon. I consider it a privilege to be with you during these sort of early days of the Dawson Centre, and just hearing David speak there. There's wisdom in the Catholic intellectual tradition that can be shared widely and can benefit folks of a whole variety of perspectives. And I see and hope that that's what the Dawson Centre will contribute here in Tasmania. I trust that you will support and assist the effort. Men and women familiar with Catholic moral and social thought can assuredly make important contributions in society. Those who act in light of it will work to promote the common good and defend the dignity of each human person, and they'll work especially to try and enlarge that sort of circle of protection given to the most vulnerable members of the human family. That, I think, will be key. So I want to wish the Dawson Centre well, David, and I hope maybe in the future I'll get invited back. I guess a lot of that might depend on the reaction to my talk this afternoon, and I wouldn't put bets on my being invited back. Friends, I have spent all my priestly ministry engaged in the apostolate of Catholic higher education in the United States. Don't ask me how a young fellow from Roma in Western Queensland ended up at Notre Dame in Indiana, but that is what happened. And as a member of the Holy Cross Order, I've served as a faculty member at Notre Dame. And one of the areas that I've given increased scholarly attention to is the role of Catholics in American public life. And I'm presently working on a book which will examine the importance of religion, or lack thereof, for a number of Catholic politicians, beginning with President John Kennedy and moving through the half century plus since his election to the White House in 1960. Many of you of, let us say, I include myself in this, of those of us of the more senior status gathered here, might remember the excitement occasioned by that election among Catholics, not only in the United States, but indeed around the world. Now, I want to connect the American story I tell with some observations from the Australian experience. There are folks here in this room who know much more about this latter area than I do. And I could be quite wrong in what I say, but I hope my observations will at least stimulate some thought and hopefully some questions. Discussion afterwards. So my book in progress will investigate such figures with whom you might be familiar. Anyone recall Senator Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy, who battled for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination in 1968? Senator Edward Kennedy and his brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver. the erudite Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Speaker of the House Thomas P. Tip O'Neill, who made famous the dictum that all politics is local. Is that true, Madeline?
Absolutely.
Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro, Walter Mondale's controversial running mate, 1984. Notable governors like Mario Cuomo and Robert P. Casey and so forth. And I plan to take the story down to more recent times to include the present Secretary of State, John Kerry, whom George W. Bush defeated in 2004, and then the current Vice President Joe Biden and his opponent in 2012, Congressman Paul Ryan, and the current Speaker, John Boehner, and his predecessor in that office, Nancy Pelosi. Just a quick listing of such prominent names might suggest that Catholics in the United States have played a very significant role in American public life over these past decades. But I want to suggest to you this evening that the story is much more complicated and that the Catholic impact on American public life is a much more mixed picture. I hope that my providing a sort of mere survey of this story might be of interest to you and, as I say, might aid your own reflection on the role of Catholicism in American public life, in Australian public life. Now, of course, Catholic engagement in Australian politics and public life is a complex story in its own right. Catholics in this country gravitated early on to the Australian Labor Party, right from the earliest days, just as Catholics in the US identified primarily with the Democratic Party. In each country, politicians of mainly Irish heritage emerged as notable political leaders and organizers. Those Irish just had a gift for it, didn't they, in each country? What was it? Their love of words, I suppose, contributed. Similarly, tensions between Catholics and non-Catholics occasionally surfaced in each country. Catholics at times faced unfair discrimination because of their faith in each nation from Protestant majorities and sort of WASP establishments. Although this seems to have run deeper in the United States, just a decidedly Protestant nation. Although, of course, it was significant here, especially up through the 1950s. Catholics emerged to greater prominence more quickly in Australia. Soon after Al Smith, the first Catholic candidate for the US presidency, was going down to a decisive defeat in 1928, Australia elected its first Catholic Prime Minister, Jim Scullin, in 1929. Poor Scullin had the Depression descend upon him, and the disputes over financial policies led Tasmania's Joseph Lyons, another and an especially devout Catholic, to split from Labor and to lead the conservative United Australia Party through the 1930s. But it was not the leadership by Catholics of political parties that drew most attention, I think, as we look back over certainly the 20th century in Australian history. It was, of course, the deep and bitter dispute within the Labor Party that pitted Catholics against Catholics. The US has nothing comparable to the dispute among Catholics in the 1950s that led to the formation of the Democratic Labor Party in 1955. The DLP was not a Catholic confessional party in the manner of some European political groups, but its leadership and its support derived mainly from Catholics. And the split was, a friend of mine says, which split are you talking about? I mean, Labour has had the World War I split, the Depression split. No, but this decisive 50s split helped keep the ALP out of power for two decades DLP preferences aided Menzies' Liberal Party to stay in office, until 1972. A signature issue for Catholics for much of the post-war era was financial support, state aid, for Catholic schools. And DLP pressure helped Menzies make his initial moves on this issue in 1963, and over the next decade, both sides of Australian politics reached their appropriate and lasting accommodations, with Gough Whitlam very important in pushing the Labor Party on this issue. He should always be remembered and thanked for his great contribution. With this issue sort of largely settled, whatever may be the disputes about how monies might be distributed, the issue is broadly settled. It seemed that some of the religious fervour for Catholics seemed to dissipate somewhat. Catholics also increasingly began to be found on both sides of the political divide, especially from the 1970s onwards. The more experienced among us, such as folks here, might remember that when Philip Lynch was a senior member of Malcolm Fraser's ministries in the late 70s, people observed something about the fact that he was a Catholic in among all these Protestants. But as we know, times have changed when one looks at the makeup of the Abbott cabinet. By the way, aid to Catholic schools was an issue on which it would prove impossible for Catholics in the US to make much progress. Very strict Supreme Court interpretations on the doctrine of separation of church and state proved impossible to negate. Thus, while the large Catholic elementary and secondary school system in Australia has continued to flourish, at least in terms of numbers and resources, in the US, each successive year brings news of more closings of Catholic schools. This situation sometimes perplexes Australian observers of the US scene, but perhaps it will be more understandable if I turn to explore in more detail, and in some considerable detail, the American story from JFK forwards. One must begin, of course, with John Kennedy, who remains the only Catholic elected to the highest political office in the US. Despite prejudice and deep Protestant suspicion, Kennedy very narrowly, won the 1960 election, carried over the edge by his winning a very large percentage of the Catholic vote, back at a time when that really meant something. Folks thought of themselves voting as Catholics, upwards of 75% of the Catholic vote. JFK's election seemed to shatter the last political barrier obstructing America's acceptance of Catholics. And Kennedy's apparent idealism, his stated willingness to conquer new frontiers, and then, of course, his tragic assassination locked him into a revered position in the American public mind. Certainly, many Catholics accorded him such treatment. The always interesting Father Andrew Greeley, a renowned Chicago priest, just died a couple of years back, even asked in 1967 if JFK should not be canonized because he had, quote, put to rest forever the fear that Catholicism was an alien religion and that Catholic political leaders would use their positions to interfere with American freedoms. Yet, in the perspective given by the last five decades, it seems clear that such evaluations might be, let us say, somewhat inflated. Dare one say it? It's certainly hard to say it to some Americans of a certain vintage and ethnic heritage. But I can tell you're an audience that can handle this kind of observation. I trust you can handle this related point. The election of a Catholic to the presidency meant very little in terms of the impact of religion on public policy. The election of JFK meant only a conditional acceptance of Catholicism into the mainstream of American life. And it was an acceptance made on conditions which Kennedy explicitly promised he would accept, essentially that he would relegate his religion to a purely private status, and that he would not act on public policy in any recognizably Catholic way. Now, as the historian James Hitchcock rather sarcastically noted, this promise was rendered immeasurably easier by the fact, revealed later by a number of people, including his wife, that President Kennedy was neither very devout nor very knowledgeable about his religion. Indeed, dear Jackie Kennedy reported to Arthur Kroc, a famous journalist at the New York Times, quote, "I think it's so unfair of people to be against Jack because he is Catholic. He's such a poor Catholic." I don't know what that means if your wife says that about you, but regrettably, JFK does not appear to have been overly influenced by a religious worldview or, let us say, by religiously based convictions. Both critics of JFK, like Gary Wills, who describes JFK as essentially a rootless person, you know, he had no grounding, and court historians who loved him and worked with him and knew him, like Arthur Schlesinger, who said JFK took religion, quote, with detachment. Any of you take your religion with detachment? Maybe I've had a couple of bad days myself. I better not be casting any stones, but they agree on this. Now, who knows for sure what role faith plays in someone's inner life? But the external evidence suggests that JFK was what might be termed, in the American context, a political Catholic, a public persona maintained because it was essential to his winning office in heavily Catholic Massachusetts. But then, more of a problem to be addressed when seeking higher national office in a nation still very suspicious of Catholics. In narrow political terms, JFK dealt with the issue effectively, indeed brilliantly, in the 1960 campaign. In his famous speech to the Protestant ministers in Houston, in September of 1960, he addressed the issue head on. We must remember that this was a speech designed to address a political problem in his campaign. He's trying to win office. He wasn't trying to outline deep philosophy. Nonetheless, he wanted to silence his critics. In this speech, JFK advocated an extreme form of church-state separation and essentially the privatization of religion. He said this, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, absolute." He made clear that his religion would not influence how he exercised public office. He would compartmentalize his faith, it seemed. By and large, I argue JFK kept his promise. The Kennedy administration adopted what one writer has called a sort of modern pragmatism. Matters of right and wrong were not so important. Rather, the issue was what would work? What would further the political success of the Kennedy administration? What would assure JFK's re-election in 1964? His cautious stance on civil rights is, I think, evidence for this. JFK gave clear voice to his approach in a notable commencement address at Yale University in June of 1962, where he proclaimed matters of philosophy, you know, all those stuff of morality and so on. That's basically passé. Now the task was practical management, facing up to the sophisticated and technical questions involved in making a government run. Not surprisingly then, his was an administration peopled by the best and the brightest, like Robert McNamara, who supposedly could just crunch the numbers, do a cost-benefit analysis, and come out with the correct conclusions. We won't go into what sometimes resulted from Robert McNamara's cost-benefit analyses. Now, if my understanding is correct, then the impact of the election of a Catholic rather ironically meant a further triumph of the secular in the public sphere, as the Jesuit historian Mark Masser demonstrated so well in his very fine book called Catholics and American Culture. In the end, the First Amendment, which was written to protect religion from government, the First Amendment's written to protect religious freedom, hopefully to assure its flourishing. This amendment was in a way used by the Kennedy administration to separate the government from religious influence. There were notable exceptions, of course, like one of my heroes, Sergeant Shriver, founder of the Peace Corps, but we're reflecting here on the general thrust of the administration. Sadly, Kennedy not only blazed a trail of privatizing religion, but he pursued this rather secular course. And the hazy and sentimental recollections that surround JFK and, you know, the terrible tragedy of his assassination and so on, we can't let those recollections disguise this for us. We have to be tough-minded and accept it. He blazed a trail, however, which many subsequent American politicians who were Catholics have followed. And that's why I've spent so much time on him. Ironically, a quite different course for Catholic politicians was charted by the bishops gathered at the Second Vatican Council. In December of 1965, in the final session of the council, the great document, Gaudium et Spes, the Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, was issued. Developed a theme of openness to the world, rather optimistic in tone, gave voice to a sense that there was much common ground among Christians of various denominations and also non-Christians. We could work for the common good. The Council Fathers emphasized the interdependence of the person and society, the importance of the common good, the innate dignity of every human person. From these foundations, Gaudium et Spes approached very positively the issue of Catholics' participation in political life. Quote, "The Church regards as worthy of praise and consideration," the document states, "the work of those who, as a service to others, dedicate themselves to the welfare of the state and undertake the burdens of this task." Thus, the council honored the political vocation and encouraged Christians to consider it. Importantly, then, Gaudium et Spes conveyed clearly that Christian politicians were called to engage the modern world in ways that promoted these great principles, dignity of every person, the common good. They were to serve within their domains as leaven, if you will. They certainly were not to see their political activities as separate from their religious commitments. This must be emphasized. Quote from Gaudium et Spes. "Let there be no false opposition between professional and social activities on the one part and religious life on the other." There was to be no privatizing of religion, no sequestering of faith into some special compartment that had no impact on the rest of one's activities. Gaudium et Spes, which I suggest offered excellent, if very general guidance for how Catholics should pursue politics, received Pope Paul VI's signature on December 7th, 1965, We might say it provided a more integrated model in contrast to the separate or privatized model that I say JFK charted. Now, as you would expect, I explore in my book, and I've worked on a number of chapters thus far, which approach was adopted and why by the various politicians I cover. Some of them I've mentioned at the outset there. Many, of course, are to be found somewhere on a sort of spectrum. Politicians of the centre-left in the Democratic Party in the United States eventually appealed more to what might be called the social gospel teachings of the church to support policies involving usually a more enhanced role for government. Politicians of the more centre-right, Republicans, stood out more clearly over time for commitment to church teachings on matters of personal dignity, especially regarding respect for human life. This was especially the case in the US as the issue of legalized abortion emerged as a national issue after the 1973 Supreme Court decision, Roe versus Wade. Now, no doubt, a somewhat similar phenomenon of politicians being on a spectrum occurred in Australia, but I shall double back to address that matter. Permit me now to offer a sort of a little survey of how American Catholic politicians address this relationship of faith and politics. I hope it will be of some interest. It's going to be a very quick, hurried survey. The initial impact of Gaudi et Spes in the US coincided with a period in which the optimistic mood which began the 60s was considerably tempered. Nonetheless, the efforts of Lyndon Johnson's administration in civil rights, in its war on poverty and so on, seemed broadly in sync with the thrust of the pastoral constitution in regard to promoting the common good, enhancing the dignity of persons. Boy, you know, the Civil Rights Act, African Americans at long last getting justice and the right to vote, etc., etc. Was that enhancing the dignity of people or what? Catholic liberals of the American sort seemed supported in a general sense by the social teachings of the council. Conservative Catholics like William F. Buckley of National Review expressed reservations about the work of Vatican II, but Catholic liberals took heart from the pastoral constitution, and after 1966, two liberal Catholic senators increasingly moved towards the center stage of American politics, Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy. I have a chapter in which I look at the two of them together. And of course, in 1968, they emerged as top contenders for the Democratic presidential nomination. I won't go into all the details about them. But suffice to say, both Robert Kennedy and Gene McCarthy, in their different ways, gave hopes of modeling for a new generation of Catholic politicians a way of relating religious convictions with political endeavors that would be more in line with the call of the Second Vatican Council. They weren't seeking to separate off religion, as JFK had done. Sadly, little came of their efforts. By 1968, when McCarthy and Kennedy campaigned for the Democratic nomination, U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War had come to dominate the American political agenda. Both McCarthy and Kennedy emerged as opponents of Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam War policies, and their candidacies had this oppositional tone which precluded them putting forth a more full and positive agenda. And of course, neither gained power, and so neither was able to demonstrate through action the sort of nature of their full approach. Kennedy was slain in Los Angeles in June of 1968, and Gene McCarthy lost the nomination to Hubert Humphrey, and with it seems, his bearings. He went into what one writer has called a prolonged sulk and left the Senate and the world of serious politics behind. I consider it a tragic loss, as he was a politician with the intellectual powers to forge a public approach which combine concern for the dignity of the individual with concern for the common good. Of course, lots of things were happening in the United States in those difficult years, concluding the 1960s. Not only did 1968 see the removal of RFK and McCarthy as potential exemplars for Catholic politicians, it also marked the occasion for an enormous upheaval in the US. Gaudium et Spes had referred rather optimistically to the churches contributing to social and cultural transformation of the world. But the late 60s saw unleashed a series of forces that significantly changed the arena in which Catholic politicians would be called upon to work. We can only allude to these forces here, although one gets a sense of the magnitude of them if one takes seriously the judgment of a very sober historian, Philip Gleason, that during the decade, the nation as a whole experienced its greatest upheaval, indeed crisis, since the Civil War. Not the wars, not World War I, not World War II, but this time when a kind of virtual social revolution that was transforming institutions and so on went on. And at this very time, of course, that the nation was going through this upheaval, the church itself, through the work of the council, set about a series of changes in practices and institutions that left Catholics in what Gleason termed a state of some confusion. It was hardly a kind of an easy combination. Looking back, I think we can see that some of the key driving forces of the 60s revolution were sort of individualism and atomization. Emerging from the 60s came an ethos of personal liberation, sexual freedom, self-fulfillment, and rather strangely, this ethos increasingly found its political home in the Democratic Party, which had been more seemingly the party of collective endeavors, working for the common good. Rather strangely, this ethos was quickly associated with the Democrats when they nominated George McGovern in 1972. The party that had been the traditional home of Catholics from the mid-19th century onwards began to move in directions decidedly contrary to some of the social teaching of the Catholic Church. Strangely, as this remarkable transformation of the Democratic Party took place, most Catholic office holders largely stood by and sort of acquiesced in the process. And I still need to work harder to understand better why they did. Edward Kennedy, the third prominent Kennedy brother in politics, quickly overcame any reservations about the new direction of the Democratic Party and became a vocal spokesperson for it. Kennedy's brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, McGovern's eventual running mate in 1972, and a deeply serious and committed Catholic, tried to hold to a more integrated Catholic approach, emphasizing the common good, pro-life stance, etc., but he met only electoral defeat in the Democratic primaries during 1976, where an unknown Georgia governor named Jimmy Carter emerged victorious. Without any great or significant debate, the sort of social cultural liberalism of the contemporary Democratic Party quickly took hold at the national level with its emphasis on individual autonomy and privacy. Catholic Democrats, even old-style New Deal Catholic liberals like Tip O'Neill, who's the House Speaker, discovered that to get ahead, one must sort of go along with the now dominant wing of the party, especially influential on both coasts, California and the sort of New York area. They had a lot of money at their disposal. Someone like Tip lacked the political intellectual capacity to fashion how a Catholic politician should appropriately pursue his public vocation in this new political circumstance. Indicative of the triumph of the privatization of religion for Catholics, the new expression developed that while one was personally opposed to something on moral or religious grounds, one could not seek to impose one's views on others. One must leave decisions to their individual choice. This approach was certainly evidenced by the Catholic Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro in her run for the vice presidency in 1984. Ferraro's strongly pro-choice position appeared to develop from the political requirements necessary to make a way in the Democratic Party. She gave no well-considered defense of it. The privatized religion model triumphed despite the efforts and appeal of those who push for a more consistent ethic of life or seamless garment approach in the 1980s. And the courageous efforts and witness of the pro-life governor of Pennsylvania, Robert P. Casey. Casey was even denied the opportunity to speak at the Democratic Convention in 1992. Abortion and support for it strangely became a kind of litmus test in the Democratic Party at the national level. The increasingly blunt pronouncements from official church teaching regarding the responsibilities of Catholic politicians in encyclicals like Evangelium Vitae and so forth went largely unnoticed. Jump ahead to 2004. John Kerry, another Catholic senator from Massachusetts, he even had the initials JFK, and he wanted to follow the first JFK into the Oval Office. Kerry could describe himself as a believing and practicing Catholic. Yet there was a sense that he was guided essentially by the same modern pragmatism that had guided his hero JFK. 40 years on from Vatican II, Kerry wanted to make it clear, just as JFK had done, that he would be a president who happened to be Catholic, not a Catholic president in any meaningful way. Perhaps not surprisingly, he came across as a secular, Ivy League-trained, Massachusetts-type liberal who emphasized his pro-choice stance and went to NARAL rallies. He still went to Mass on Sunday. He even got ashes on his forehead on Ash Wednesday, at least in that campaign year he did, where the cameras were being flashed. But it didn't seem that he didn't seem able to convey that his religion shaped his public outlook. Perhaps because it didn't in any noticeable way. But let me ask, how would John Kerry have fit into Australian political life? Wouldn't he have found a place here rather easily? Gaudium et Spes's more integrated approach seemed to have no especially deep impact here, with notable exceptions. It might be one of those exceptions in this room today. I would suggest that for most Catholic politicians in Australia, and please correct me, I need to understand this all better, but most Catholic politicians in Australia seem to possess, as the 1980s moved into the 1990s, a kind of unspoken and rather implicit agreement not to make too much publicly of their religious outlook. There was certainly not a desire to fully privatize one's religious convictions, as I think there was in the US. But here they were to be held within careful bounds. There seemed concern that politicians who wore their religion on their sleeves might meet substantial public resentment. Perhaps it was the bitter sectarian struggles of the 50s and 60s that had, as I say, with some notable exceptions, made politicians hesitant to invoke religion. Few politicians of any denomination gave explicit voice to their religious convictions and what they might mean for politics and policies. Occasional exceptions prove the rule. Note the attention given to the then Health Minister Tony Abbott's 2004 Adelaide University lecture on, quote, the ethical responsibilities of a Christian politician. Folks are like, what's Abbott talking about? And even more so, that given the then opposition leader Kevin Rudd's article in the October 2006 issue of The Monthly entitled Faith in Politics. Folks were a little worried about Kevin after that. Perhaps they had other reasons to worry about him. I don't think his religion was one of them. Similarly, Catholic politicians were not expected to be too closely identified publicly with what might be seen as issues of special concern for Catholics, such as the range of so-called life issues, beginning of life, end of life issues, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research, etc. The general acceptance of changes to Australia's abortion laws on all sides of politics seemed to confirm this, but perhaps I'm wrong. Let me suggest further that the sort of integrated vision for how Catholic politicians might engage the modern world, as set forth in Gaudium et Spes, has been fairly minimal. Certainly in the United States, politicians have hid behind the notion that religion is a private matter and have just sort of blended in and refrained from utilizing their religion as an inspiration and a guide for their actions. And this despite the fact that the fundamental problems of the American polity and society, things such as decline of family, breakdown of community, unrestrained individualism at the expense of the common good, threats to the dignity of human life, rampant relativism in values, growing income disparity, economic insecurity, these presented unique opportunities and challenges to Catholics in public life, and in which Catholic thought had something to contribute. Not to depress you, but prospects for any rapid change seem dim. This is the case I'm making primarily for the American scene. Folks in this room might change the dynamic in Australia. But I find this somewhat disturbing because there are some serious challenges confronting us today. The church, as an institution, and faithful Catholics are being forced to navigate through very difficult waters in the public sphere on a number of fronts, and I don't need to rehearse them all. It suffices to say that in the American context, there's an effort to force religious organizations and individuals to violate their consciences on a number of issues, and I fear it's going to get somewhat worse. This has even provoked a battle with some Catholic institutions and the federal government, particularly, as you would know, over the HHS mandate. So, I don't want to end on such a depressive note and send you out sad. Instead, I want to encourage you to see things in a longer-term perspective. We might say that this last half century has been a difficult period in which, with notable exceptions, many Catholic politicians either lost their way or at least hid their light under a bushel basket. They failed to benefit from the guidance of Gaudium et Spes. They failed to understand well that politics and faith must engage. But might we conclude with a recognition that we're still receiving the teachings of the Second Vatican Council and still understanding its depths? The task ahead for those gathered here, gathering elsewhere, is to dedicate ourselves anew to seeking to convey that one's religious convictions are not to be divorced from one's political actions. Those of us involved in the work of education, as I am, and as I know a number of folks I met beforehand are, might take special heart from the call of Gaudium et Spes for the education of youth so as to produce, quote, those great-souled persons who are so desperately required by our times. We need them now more than ever, as I'm sure you appreciate. In his first encyclical letter, which I think was terrific, Deus Caritas Est, God is Love, Pope Emeritus, Pope Benedict, reminded us that building a just social and civil order wherein each person receives what is his or her due is an essential task which every generation must take up anew. We're never going to get to this. There's always going to be work to be done. And this, of course, is essentially the work of lay women and men. And I thank those of you here tonight who are engaged in the political vocation for the work that you are undertaking. The church must continue and enhance its efforts to help inform her members in pursuing this work, and at a crucial level to have them appreciate that they are called to serve the common good, to respect the dignity of each human person. Now, dare I test your patience and make a few suggestions as to how this might be done? I know I've spoken at length, and I want to take some questions, but I want to convey just a few short points. The first I borrow from Marianne Glendon, wonderful Harvard law professor and former U.S. ambassador to the Vatican. It is this: religious participants in the public debate will not be as effective unless they can speak in terms that are persuasive to men and women of goodwill, of all faiths and of no faith. One will not get far if one preaches only to the converted. Glendon makes clear we're not trying to impose our views in the public square, but to propose them and to bring others to them. The key is to work for what is right and good by persuading others of their rightness and goodness. Linked to this, and especially important in religiously pluralist nations like the US and Australia, one must have an ecumenical approach. Assuredly, we can work in cooperative ways with like-minded folk from other Christian denominations and indeed other religious traditions. And Catholics obviously have done this in Australia. Maintaining a certain humility is also important, even though this can seem a little out of place in the occasionally ego-ridden arena of politics. I know that would not apply in any way to anyone in this room. Let me quote from Barbara Jordan, the distinguished congresswoman from Texas in the 1960s and 70s. I love this quote. "You do well to pursue your cause with vigor while realizing you are a servant of God and not the spokesperson for God, and realizing that God may well choose to bless an opposing point of view for reasons that have not been revealed to you." Connected to this is the obvious point that folks of religious outlook will not agree on all the details of policies. Gaudium et Spes says in rather formal Vatican document speak that, quote, "Christians should recognize that various legitimate though conflicting views can be held concerning the regulation of temporal affairs." So good folk can differ, and quite markedly. And I want to say we're hoping good folk would be found on both of the major sides of politics. We might all be able to agree that our various religious traditions call for us to care for the poor and the weak, the widow and the orphan, but that doesn't mean we all have to agree on exactly how it is to be done, what the annual rate of the old age pension increase should be or whatever might not be specified by teaching. Just that care for the elderly should inspire all of us should be a concern. That said, I do think there are some issues of fundamental importance, fundamental moral importance, especially those beginning and end of life questions. In their guide to faithful citizenship, the US bishops emphasized the direct and intentional destruction of innocent human life is always wrong, and is not just one issue among many. Now, while I've spoken here of the place of religion in the public sphere for politicians, it goes without saying that one's faith should guide one's private morality. Honesty and integrity should be characteristics of those who would publicly refer to their religious convictions. And lastly, religious folks have to have some sense of modesty as to what they can accomplish, some limits on what they think they can achieve on this earth and on what they see as the role of politics. Important as the political domain is, we must know well that heaven is elsewhere, and although in the Augustinian sense we have to work to have the city of God penetrate and overlap the city of man, it's an ongoing task. When you appreciate the limits of politics, you understand well that your task is not to create heaven on earth, as did the totalitarians of the last century, who succeeded only in creating hell. Pope Benedict understood this well when he explained, wherever politics tries to be redemptive, it is promising too much. Where it wishes to do the work of God, it becomes not divine, but demonic. You also would understand, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan pointed out decades ago, what it is that government cannot provide. It cannot provide values to persons who have none or have lost those that they had. It cannot provide a meaning to life. It cannot provide inner peace. It can perhaps provide outlets for moral energies, but it cannot create those energies. This gets back to a point, a sort of a Dawson point of long ago, that culture, morals, etc., are the foundations on which good politics and good economics might be built. Well, a final word again to emphasize the importance of good people entering public life, and to again thank Madeline for hosting us here. Politics is a noble calling in a democratic society, and it is to be done, as Gaudium et Spes suggested, as a service to others. I want to encourage you to encourage young people you might know to think about the political vocation. Of course, we want to suggest that they take Thomas More as a guide, the king's good servant, but God's first. Or perhaps to take some more recent examples. I've been doing some reading and thinking about that great generation of genuinely Catholic European politicians led by Germany's Konrad Adenauer, Italy's Alcide de Gasperi, France's Robert Schuman, who in the aftermath of two catastrophic world wars, European fratricide on a world scale, a devastated continent, etc., sought to rebuild something from the rubble. And they were guided by their Christian convictions, and their Christian convictions helped link them to work together, etc. Their contribution should be better known and perhaps should call a new generation forward. Our challenges are significant in our own time, but let me suggest I don't think they quite measure up to theirs. May the Lord guide our Catholic politicians and indeed each one of us. Thank you so much.
That was a talk by Father Bill Miscampbell. To find out more about the Christopher Dawson Centre for Cultural Studies, visit dawsoncentre.org. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.